Well, good afternoon, everybody, or good evening. I'm Patrick Milliken from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And sorry for our fashionably late start time today. We've had a few funny computer glitches, but so we're doing this kind of analog, utilizing some phones. And but in some ways, you know, I have two very seasoned reporters here. Somehow this seems to make sense, you know? But let me just give a quick introduction for both of them. Mark Pinsky is a veteran investigative journalist specializing in capital murder cases. Former staff writer for the Los Angeles Times and the Orlando Sentinel, his work, which has been featured in the Wall Street Journal and USA Today, has followed topics ranging from the trial of serial killer Ted Bundy to the death of Trayvon Martin. His expertise has been showcased in multiple television appearances for Investigation Discovery, True TV, and Amazon Prime. Pinsky is the author of Met Her on the Mountain, a 40-year quest to solve the Appalachian cold case murder of Nancy Morgan, which Mark tells me has just been reprinted, reissued in paperback. Very cool. And four religious books, Amazing Gifts, Stories of Faith, Disability, and Inclusion, A Jew Among the Evangelicals, The Gospel According to the Simpsons, and The Gospel According to Disney. Mark, welcome. And this is your brand new book, Drifting into Darkness. Hold it up right here. Yes, fantastic.
Thank you, Patrick, for having me. Thank you, Christina, for listening to me, I guess.
And my friend Christina Estes is a senior field correspondent for 91.5 FM KJAZZ. She focuses on stories that impact our economy, your wallet, and public policy. This is a very modest kind of bio, by the way. You need to add some more stuff to it. During her 20 plus years reporting in Phoenix, Estes has worked for a variety of news outlets and covered presidential campaigns, state and local politics, education, and business. Estes has used her journalism experience to write a mystery novel featuring a Phoenix reporter. It will be published in 2023. And Christina is a tireless supporter and advocate for the Poison Pen Bookstore. And we really appreciate all you do for us, Christina. And
I so appreciate your Zoom expertise. So thank you so much for winning this.
No problem.
Thank you so much.
Not at all. And for everybody watching, if you have questions for Mark or Christina, just go ahead and put them in the comments field as they occur to you. And I'm gonna go ahead and stay on screen this time. And I might, you know, add some questions of my own as well. But Christina, take it away.
Thank you again, Patrick. And Mark, thank you so much for hanging in there while I was literally sweating this Zoom call. Let's start with, before we get into the details of this book, talk about a little bit about how you came to write it, because your sister-in-law played a huge role. How did that happen?
In 2013, my last book, Met Her on the Mountain, came out. And after it did, my sister-in-law, my wife's sister, read it and called me and said, I have a case that I worked on as part of the defense team. I think an injustice was done in this case, and I'd like you to look into this case and maybe write a book about what happened and why, and then what didn't happen and why.
So in writing this, you had to learn about the Springford family, and these murders, Charlotte and Brent Sr., took place in 2004. Their son was arrested, eventually pled guilty to avoid the death penalty in 2008. So all of this happened, and you weren't covering it, I guess, at the time. So you had to learn a lot about the family. And your book, here it is again, Drifting into Darkness. I mean, it really has some amazing detail. I've never been to Montgomery, Alabama, certainly not to the historic Garden District where the Springfords live, but you really get a sense, and it helps the reader understand, you know, who this family was and sort of their reputation and their standing in the community. So you had to learn all of that. And in doing that, what did you learn about the relationship between the parents and Brent Jr.?
Well, when my sister-in-law urged me to write the book, I wasn't sure I wanted to do it. So she said, I'll send you my case files. I said, okay. She sent me 15 file boxes full of her case files. She worked on the case as part of the defense team. And as a journalist, as I went through it, it took me 6 months to go through all that she sent me. But I saw it quite early as a gold mine for a researcher. In addition to the normal stuff that you would expect, forensic materials, transcript, autopsy report, police report, and her interviews, she also had many emails, letters, faxes that Charlotte Springford had written. And she also had material from her personal journals. And she also had gotten from the son, who would eventually admitted what he did, also his letters, his emails, and his personal journal. So as you know, if you write true crime, at some point, since the people you need to speak to may often be dead, the form that you say is that X must have thought this, or X probably was thinking of this. But with the material that my sister-in-law sent me, I knew what the key players were thinking at the time that they did it. And since they were no longer available to me, it was just a gold mine. From that material, I found out that this couple, Brent Sr. and Charlotte Springford, were prominent people in Montgomery. They were philanthropic people. They were engaged parents. They were racially progressive. When the Southern Poverty Law Center came to Montgomery, a lot of the Polite Society shunned them, but Charlotte and Brent Sr. did not. They sort of made them their friends and brought them into their home. And I got to look at the privileged upbringing that they gave to their older son, their oldest son, Brent Jr. He went to the best prep school in Montgomery, and the mother was especially engaged. She took the kids. Brent Jr. had a sister 2 years younger, Robin, and she took them on field trips. She did whatever she could in their early years to round out their education. As Brent got into high school, they also wanted him to be, I think, a person who was not spoiled by his wealthy background. And so they asked his peer group to make their home in the Garden District the headquarters for the young people. So they had parties there. And to some degree, they were also indulgent. They knew that there was drinking going on. Later, as their children got older, they were smoking weed. But as long as they stayed in the house with their friends and their parents were in the home, they felt like nothing bad would happen to them. On one occasion, apparently, Brent Sr. opened Brent Jr.'s bedroom door, and he was in bed with a young woman, so the father just quietly backed out and closed the door. And at one point, and this is a little strange, I think, for most parents, Brent Sr. was a hard partier when he went to college. He was in a rock band. At some point, he actually gave his son, Brent Jr., his old bong, drug apparatus. And so, but at the same time—
That could be a little strange for some people to comprehend.
Exactly.
And doesn't Brent, fall far from the tree is what you're saying.
Right. I mean, but Brent was a good student. He was conscientious. He brought home fellow students who were newcomers or for some reason weren't in the inner circle. He sort of adopted people because he was a considerate person. He was an altruistic person. Summers, the whole family went to Mexico to learn languages. And Brent Jr.'s teachers thought a great deal of him. He was a good student. And so this was the way the young man was brought up by his parents. He was bright, but there were some early inklings that he might be a little troubled. Nothing serious at the beginning until he left for Vanderbilt University.
So you write, like, I think it was his sophomore year of college that things began to change, or somebody noted there were noticeable changes, maybe is the way to phrase it.
Yes, he had finished his sophomore year at Vanderbilt. As at the prep school he went to, his professors really liked him a lot. He got interested in both New Age religion, but also Eastern religion, Buddhism and Hinduism, and took courses and became a serious student of it. However, by this time, he was about 20 or 21. And at this point, things happen often with young men. There's a normal period of separation from the parents. That's one thing that happens sometimes. He became, again, interested in Eastern religions, and that sort of distanced him a little bit more. But the third thing was, his mother knew that her family had three generations of bipolar disorder. And that history included suicides, alcoholism, institutionalization. but she never told her son about this because she was afraid he would see it as a self-fulfilling prophecy. So by the end of his sophomore year, as he began to drift away from his parents, they were unable to separate what the cause of that was. Was it normal separation? Was his interest in Eastern religions? Or was it incipient symptoms of bipolar disorder? And so at the end of his sophomore year, he said he wanted to take a leave to do more serious study of Buddhism and Hinduism. He wanted to go to monasteries and retreats. His parents were uneasy, but they didn't want to yank the chain. And so they said, okay, for a year, with the advice of one of his professors, they said, okay. And they said he could go for a year and go to these various places in both in Mexico, but also in the US. And but 1 year stretched into 2 years and 3 years and 4 years. And the parents were increasingly anxious about his mental condition, actually.
You write about an encounter, I think it was in Colorado, when he said, I'm going to, you know, go to school in Colorado. And there was an encounter there that really changed his course. He met someone there, which yes. is what prompted the whole book and your interest in it in particular. So what happened in Colorado? Who did he meet? What happened?
After where he was basically working his way across the country at various monasteries and retreats, and then his parents really wanted him to go back to college. And he said, okay, I'll go back, but I want to go to Naropa University in Boulder, which is a respected Buddhist institution. They would have preferred he return to Vanderbilt, but they thought, well, let's see where this goes. So he entered Naropa University. He did very well. He enjoyed it. And he met a woman who was his roommate. He just saw a sign, you know, a paper on a bulletin board. And he roomed with this woman. And this woman's family lived in Boulder. They were wealthy people as well, accomplished people in their fields. And they had a kind of informal salon at their home in Boulder. And Brent Jr. went to the home not to go to the salon, but to help care for the father of the family who was ill. And just on his own, Brent volunteered to give respite to the other members of the family. And while he was there, there was what proved to be a fatal encounter. At this salon, he met this woman who said she was a Native American shaman. She was the last of the Apache medicine women. And she dressed the part, and she knew the language, she knew the nomenclature. And when Brent saw her, he fell to his knees, knocked his head on the ground, and said, I found my spiritual guide. And for the previous 4 or 5 years, he kept reading books about people who had, you know, spiritual enlightenment, how they reached enlightenment. And he kept reading these books, and he kept wondering, why is this not happening to me? It happened. I'm open to it. I want it to happen. And then at that moment, in that salon in Boulder, he basically put himself under the tutelage and the sway of this woman named Caroline Scout. And at first it was gradual. He wrote a paper about this woman for his class in Naropa. And as the spring semester ended, he told his parents he wanted to go with this woman to her small ranch up in Wyoming to learn about Native American customs and to work as a kind of handyman on her ranch. Now, the parents were very conscientious by this time, and they made two visits out to Wyoming to meet this woman to see if she was really what their son thought she was. They were also initially impressed with her, and they made two visits out there, and they had another kind of quiet agenda in that before this, one time he came home to Montgomery, his parents had a black tie open house at Christmas, and Brent Jr. showed up in a monk's robe with his head shaved. And obviously there was some angst at the party, but also amongst his family. And so I think his family really wanted him to be treated, to get psychiatric care. But I think they also wanted him out of Montgomery and away from their social circle because he might embarrass them. And so they seized on this relationship, and they began to see this woman as a caretaker, a caregiver, and they thought they could use her influence over their son to get him into psychiatric care.
And, well, it seems like at one point there was some psychiatric care, but that certainly wasn't the priority. The years, it just, it seemed like a a wild ride, I guess, to say the least, because the parents are supporting Brent Jr. And in turn, do you say Caroline? Because I was reading it as Carolyn. Is it Caroline?
Caroline. Yes. They, in a sense, they were successful. Caroline got him into psychiatric treatment. He saw four different private psychiatrists. He went in for 72-hour observation twice. But as sometimes happens with bipolar disorder, when the psychiatrists were able to get the drug cocktail correct, he would be fine. And being fine, he said, well, I'm fine. I don't need the drugs anymore. And then he'd go off the drugs and he'd get in the same bipolar cycle that the people did. And over the next 4 or 5 years, his parents, because they were grateful for this to this woman, they thought she was doing their son good, began sending money, at first unasked for, later it was asked for. And they began sending money. The woman had three grown children. They were giving the family cars. Ultimately, they bought a home, $500,000 home in Greeley, Colorado, in order to get the family away from Wyoming and closer to Boulder and Denver, where they thought their son could get better psychiatric care. What they didn't realize was that Caroline and her family had moved into this home, but poor Brent was still up in Wyoming in South Dakota working on oil rigs, hearing voices and sounds more and more, working in the winter, sleeping in the back of a truck. Finally, Caroline agreed to call him into the home. So he moved to this home in Greeley, Colorado, but the family lived in the home, but this woman, Caroline, made Brent live in the garage. And what the parents didn't realize is that early on, she had driven with Brent Jr. into South Dakota, to Deadwood, South Dakota, and had secretly married him and told him not to tell his parents. And at the time he was 24, she was 48, which he didn't know at the time. And later he said he was bewildered why she wanted to get married, because the marriage was no sex. They didn't sleep in the same bed. They didn't sleep in the same bedroom. And when they got to Colorado, he had to live in a makeshift place in the garage. She mocked him because of his increasing irrationality, and her children mocked him. And he was not allowed in the house that his parents had paid for unless he was invited. So this took place over 4 or 5 years. And the best we can determine, probably between $1.5 million and $2 million went from Montgomery to Colorado. And the demands became increasing, and they didn't come orally. Brent would make these demands in emails, in letters, in faxes. And the tone of these demands, increasing demands, sounded more like Caroline than they did Brent Jr. And over time, the parents became more and more suspicious. And in the autumn of 2004, they decided they were being taken for a ride. Brent's sister, Robin, was about to be married at a very fashionable wedding in the height of the season, social season in Montgomery. And she had asked Brent Jr. to come, but the parents then persuaded their daughter to disinvite Brent from the wedding. As Brent Sr. once said, we were afraid he might show up with an AK-47 and shoot everybody at the wedding. So being disinvited obviously crushed Brent Jr. And after the wedding, the parents decided they were going to cut Caroline off and cut Brent Jr. off. And this was sort of the last straw. 5 weeks after they decided to cut off the funds, Charlotte Springford learned that they had been married secretly. She'd been looking all over Colorado at courthouses. She'd been looking in Wyoming, but she didn't think to go to South Dakota. So, but a week after she discovered that they were secretly married, Brent Jr. got on a bus in Boulder, took several buses until he got to Montgomery. It was Thanksgiving weekend. He ran from the bus station to his home, and he knew that there was a window in one of the bedrooms that was not on the burglar alarm system, broke the window, sneaked into the room. His parents were not there. They were in Birmingham for a Thanksgiving dinner. He slept the night in and around the home. And the next morning, Friday, when the parents came back from Thanksgiving dinner en route to their Gulf of Mexico home. Exact details we're not sure, but he set upon first his father in a fury using an axe handle and beat him to death, and then really butchered him with a knife. And we think a few minutes later, his mother came up the stairs and he attacked his mother. We know that she, unlike the father who evidently had no warning, she knew what was happening because she had defensive wounds. And at first the attack didn't kill her, and she tried to crawl from where she had fallen on the bedroom floor to a telephone. And he stabbed her and she was killed as well.
Their murders in 2004, and it was 2008 when their son pleaded guilty to avoid the death penalty. What is going on in those years? Because he was still married and there was communication still with Caroline.
Right. This I got mainly from my sister-in-law, but my sister-in-law went out there because they were going to arrest him. He was in a psychiatric facility when they took him into custody. Then he was extradited to Montgomery, where he faced the possibility of the death penalty. And that's when the defense team, including my sister-in-law, went out there to investigate. And her first suspicion was that this woman, Caroline, kept calling her and not asking about the state of his case or what his likelihood would be. She kept asking about the state of the estate. She wanted to know what she might inherit under various outcomes. So, for example, she believed wrongly that if Brent Jr. was convicted and given the death penalty and executed, she would be, as his widow, the successor in interest for his share in the considerable fortune that his family had amassed. On the other hand, she thought that if he was found not guilty by reason of insanity and institutionalized, she would again be the successor in interest, and she would get his part of the family estate. In no state can you profit from a crime. And Alabama had some more laws of its own that were really very strict as to whether heirs, basically prohibiting heirs from a killer from profiting from the crime. And as soon as she figured out that she wasn't going to get the money, she basically cut off communication with Brent Jr. So he's sitting in a jail in Montgomery waiting for his trial and to see whether he would, you know, if he would be convicted, if he would face the death penalty. And he was so under Caroline's sway that he would do nothing that would expose her to any judicial danger, either accessory before the fact or accessory after the fact, because in the days following the murders, she gave Brent a false alibi. She said he was in Colorado the whole time, never went to Alabama. And it was only over time that alibi fell apart, and it was clear that she had given police wrong information to protect Brent Jr. And then finally she got a lawyer and she said, well, I made a mistake in my recollections, to get it out of the way. And so, because Brent Jr. wouldn't do anything involving his own defense without her approval, it was driving her attorneys and my sister-in-law, who was called death penalty mitigation specialist, it was driving her crazy. And so they had to get Brent Jr. to do anything to cooperate in his own defense. They had to convince Caroline to tell Brent Jr. what to do. Otherwise, he wouldn't do it. And in the end, he wouldn't accept the plea deal unless Caroline told him to accept the plea deal. And there was really some wacky stuff. I mean, he told one of his attorneys that if they put him on the witness stand, he intended to recite his fraternity creed, the ATO creed, and recite the Song of Hiawatha poem. So you can imagine what these two lawyers were trying to save this guy's life. They're pulling their hair out because they couldn't get their own client to assist them. And when they tried to get shrinks to make the case that he was not competent, the judge didn't accept that ruling. So he couldn't be found not guilty by reason of insanity because they didn't accept the results of his psychiatric records. So they were, you know, they didn't know what to do at some point. So finally, my sister-in-law prevailed upon Caroline to tell Brent Jr. to accept this deal, that he would plead guilty to first degree murder to both of his parents. And in exchange, he would get life without parole but he wouldn't be executed, life without parole. And they said he would be put in a secure psychiatric prison unit, which as the events unfolded, turned out not to be so secure because 5 years later, he committed suicide in prison.
And some people would think, well, that's the end of the story. He committed suicide, the person that killed his parents, end of story, but not for you, right? There was another body that you discovered had ties to Caroline.
Right. I thought I was done after my second trip to Montgomery. I thought, well, he lived in Boulder just because, you know, how reporters can be obsessive sometime about a loose end to follow it up. So I thought, well, I'll go out to Boulder and just get an idea of what his life was like out there. I didn't know many people in Boulder. And so I broke one of my rules. I didn't seek any publicity for this, my investigation, up until this point. Because as people who are familiar with true crime, if you have what's called a good murder, you're afraid if too many people know about it, the tabloid TV people will swoop in. Or in my case, even worse, a better writer might sweep in and take over my case. So we didn't look for any publicity. But while I was in Boulder, I thought, I don't know people here. So I went to the Boulder Weekly, which is the alt weekly there, and told them why I was there. And they liked the story so far. And so they put the story and me on the cover for two issues going. I thought, well, that's good. Some people who did know Brent contacted me as I had hoped, and they were very helpful. And I went back to Central Florida where I lived. And then about a week later, I get a call from a private investigator who had worked on Brent's defense team and had volunteered to help me pro bono for 3 or 4 days. And he said, well, never guess what happened. They found another body on Caroline's property up in Wyoming. And it looks like suicide, but maybe it's not suicide. So I thought, oh, well, now I've got a third act here. And so the narrative took a sudden right turn. And I did something which reporters normally do. I called the local sheriff up in Wyoming. And generally when a reporter calls a police officer in a murder investigation, they brush you off. You know, you're a civilian, you're an amateur, you can't. But I don't know whether there was not much going on that day, but the detective said, I said, do you know about the background of this woman? And he said, no, why don't you tell me? And so I told him all about the Springfords, which he didn't know about. And he said, oh, by the way, they found two insurance policies up in Wyoming that the person who committed suicide named Caroline as a sole beneficiary to two insurance policies. And I said, if I were you, you know, I don't want to tell you your business, but I wouldn't let the coroner sign a death certificate that said suicide, because once you do that, then the insurance companies will then pay off. But until you do that, they won't pay. And Caroline was, as she had with my sister-in-law, really pestering the cops saying, when are you going to sign this death certificate? And then, so they said, all right, let's wait and let's see what happened. They began investigating. And this sheriff sergeant said, why don't you come out here? If you come out here, I'll get you an interview with Caroline. And I said, how can you possibly do that? Why would she talk to me? He said, don't worry. If you come out, I'll get you the interview. So I said, okay. So I went out there and I wore my reporter's uniform, you know, the blue Oxford button down with the red tie and the blue blazer and the khakis, my uniform. And I went out there with him. He said, the reason she'll talk to you is because her adult children are in and out of minor scrapes with the law all the time. And she owes us. Also, she can't get along with her neighbors. So she's always, they're complaining about her. She's complaining about them. And so she'll do pretty much whatever we ask her to do. So we drove out there without any warning. So she couldn't prepare. We got out of his squad car and she gave him a big welcome. And he introduced me. She said, this is Mark Pinsky. He's helping us with this apparent suicide. And he wants to talk to you. And so she was sitting in front of this, restored lodge, Native American lodge, which it turns out she had built with swindled money for $500,000. And so this detective said to her, said, this is Mark's interview. Well, why did he do that? Well, if it's my interview and I ask the questions, he doesn't have to read her Miranda rights. I could ask her whatever she wanted and she would say whatever she decided to answer. And that would be that. So we spoke for 2 hours and as the tricks that reporters use, you ask the softball questions first and you increasingly get to the more pointed questions. So if they if she shuts down the interview or throws you out, at least you've got an interview. So if anyone asks you later, did you ever ask her this? You could say, yes, I had an interview with her. So I finally said, my sister-in-law named Susan Wardell, who you know, told me that she had found someone in the Alabama prison system who had roomed with Brent Jr. and that Brent Jr. had told this guy that Caroline had orchestrated the murder of Brent's parents, that she was in fact the intellectual author of this murder. And I said, having said that, I said, I'm honor bound to ask if that's true. She said, no, it's not true, et cetera, et cetera. So we ended the interview, we left. And as we walked down the hill and we're about to get into the squad car, the sheriff's deputy said, oh, by the way, I kept my body cam on. Would you like a copy of this interview? I said, well, what? Yes, I think I would. And so as we drove back.
Not normal. That's very bizarre. What was your reaction? Was it like what I just did or?
Yeah. Is that legal, by the way?
Well, you know, what I found in two books now that law enforcement in rural areas tends to be a bit relaxed. And they don't follow all the rules that you would expect from an urban police department. And then I thought, well, I'm the beneficiary of this, whatever it is. And the next day, the deputy called me at my motel up in Wyoming. And he said, you know, we're going to convene a task force on, this was a Saturday. He said, we're going to convene a task force on Monday morning. Would you like to sit in? I said, okay, you know, never happened before. And if I was working for a newspaper, they wouldn't have let me do that because you have to choose what role you're going to play in one of these investigations. But by this time I left my newspaper, I was an author now. So I said, sure, I'll come. So I go to the sheriff's department on Monday morning and there's this officer's there, another officer's there, and two women who were elected coroners in the area were there. And we sit in the squad room and this deputy said, okay, Mark, you go first. What? And so I said, okay. And I told him all that I knew about the Springford case and all that I knew about the relationship between Caroline and Brent Jr. And they told me that they learned that this man who had apparently killed himself was also from Boulder, and he knew Brent Jr. while in Boulder, and that like Brent Jr., he was sort of a mentally vulnerable person. And they subsequently learned that the Caroline had, while he was alive, had basically bilked him out of $300,000 from his father's estate. And then she stood to earn another $300,000 from the two insurance policies. And they began finding that she had been grifting people, conning people all over the West, raising money for what she said was a counseling center for abused Native American women and children. And in fact, she was using that money to build this elaborate lodge on her ranch, basically as her primary residence. So, go on. You can ask me a question now.
I'm still stunned over the fact that the police were like, come hang out with us. But I can sort of get that they weren't a witness and you were like this jackpot, this wealth of information. So what happened then? They convened this task force. Did that change? Was it no longer considered an apparent suicide? And what happened?
There was some difficulty, some local difficulty as happens. The more incriminating information they turned up on Caroline Scout, they turned over to the local prosecutor, but he turned out to be a fairly lazy guy and he really didn't want to go ahead with any prosecution, regardless of the damning material, either from the Springford case or from the physical evidence around this man's body. And this man who died was not in a romantic relationship with Caroline. He was not married to her. He was not living in the same house. He was in a trailer on her ranch, basically working as a handyman. And it turned out that she had done what she had done with Brent Jr. She had started a joint checking account and all this man's meager earnings, first from wildcatting and then in a convenience store, went to this joint checking account and he had no checks. So she had all of the money that he was earning, she was getting. despite all this, the prosecutor didn't want to proceed. And so the two coroners said, well, if he won't get off his butt, we'll convene what's known as a coroner's inquest, which is like a trial, but a lot looser. And we'll carry the ball. If he won't do it, we will. And they then enlisted state investigators to take a closer look at the death scene. This man was alleged to have killed himself with a shotgun. And the more the state investigators looked, the more fishy the whole thing looked. And these coroners were getting closer and closer. They convened a coroner's inquest in Wyoming. And I've been covering murders for over 40 years. And for the first time, I was called to the witness stand. I've covered a lot of witnesses, but I've never been one. And so I was called to the witness stand. And they said, tell the jurors a little bit about Caroline Scout. And so I told the jurors, the coroner's jurors, my story. And my sister-in-law, Susan Wardell, flew out and she testified as well. And other people testified about what happened in Wyoming. And at the end of the day, the coroner's inquest ruled that this apparent suicide was not a suicide, that it was a homicide. And they said later that they thought Caroline either did it herself or convinced someone else to do it for her or talked him into doing it. And so the noose was kind of tightening over time. And this prosecutor who wouldn't do anything, he was eventually thrown out of office. People were just impatient with him. And as we got closer and closer to some sort of judicial reckoning in the criminal system, Caroline died of apparently natural causes. And so there was no resolution legally. And that put the pressure on me. My sister-in-law said, your book should be the trial that she never had, because Brent Jr. was really a victim in this. I mean, he killed his parents. There's no doubt about that. But she was really the evil person who did this. And she basically escaped justice, at least until now.
Was she Native herself?
No. It turns out she was not Native
American. Of course
not. She was not Native American. She was born in Southern California. Her name was original name was Carol Gonzalez. And the birth certificate said Caucasian. Although, you know, many Hispanic people in North America have Indian blood, but she was not registered to any trial. They turned out she had had four or five previous marriages. She had three social security numbers. She'd used five or six different names all across the Southwest and the West. And she was able to exert influence, not just on Brent Jr. and this man who was found dead on her property, but other people came forward who testified that she had taken advantage of them financially, mostly. And again, these were people who were susceptible to certain metaphysical beliefs, which I don't denigrate, but she conned people who were susceptible to being conned, or really good people who were susceptible to this notion that they were helping abuse Native American women and children.
So Mark, let me ask you, as you were investigating Caroline, how did you find out what her birth certificate said and these other names? I'll leave it at that. I'll let you just answer that question.
Right. I can't claim credit for much of it. Because the two coroners had kind of the force of law behind them, they were able to get documents and get information that I wasn't able to get. I did turn up someone who had been conned out of $500,000 from her daughter's trust fund, but was so embarrassed that she had been taken, she didn't press charges. The birth certificate came from one of the coroners, found it, and they also found her elementary and junior high school records, which, you know, you wouldn't normally be able to get, but they got them, and a lot of really great insight into what happened. And I'll go back to some of the material that my sister-in-law dug up. Normally, you can't get psychiatric records because of HIPAA, the confidentiality. But because the defense had subpoena power, they were able to subpoena Brent Jr.'s psychiatric records. And when I had them in my office, they stood a foot and a half off the ground. And using those, you could get really insight into the torment that he was going through. And at the same time, I would go back to the material, the contemporaneous material, there's letters and various things that his parents went through. And you could just feel the sort of agony. The parents didn't know until the end what was the best way. The mother said, should we cut them off now? Is she a gold digger? Should we exercise tough love? And these letters are heartbreaking. She wrote to her own friends who were psychiatrists and friends. And these were not disengaged parents. Brent's parents were not disengaged. They were not, fatuous rich people. They were philanthropic and they were caring parents. And, you can see this train wreck coming down the tracks. And it's, as a parent, I have, my children are 31 and 34, and it is heartbreaking. And my sister-in-law, she's what's called a death penalty mitigation specialist. So most of her clients, and most of the people in this country who face the death penalty tend to be, Black, brown, and poor. But she had this case, and you can sort of dissociate sometimes when you're covering these cases, that these people are not like me for one reason or another. But when she had Brent Jr. as a client, she saw her own kids and she really identified with him. And she became so frustrated because she became convinced that Caroline had manipulated him to doing this murder and that he would not hear a bad word about her. No matter what negative material my sister-in-law dug up, he wouldn't hear it. And he finally stopped talking to her because he felt that she was insulting his wife, go figure.
Can I go back to something that you mentioned about Caroline and the coroner's inquest? You said they even got her elementary and junior high school records. Is that correct? And you said something, you alluded to there was some interesting stuff in there. And so I wonder what could be interesting in elementary school records.
I think there were some early signs of kind of malevolent behavior that was not clinical, that was not criminal, but you begin to see signs of a kind of willful person, even as a young person, that if you put it in the rest of the picture, if you isolate it, would be nothing. But if you put it as part of another piece of the puzzle, you begin to see her development. She was a striver. She really wanted to, she was at a single mother. She had some abilities and had ambitions to go to college, but the teachers doubted that she had the ability to do that. And she was, her mother wanted her to take secretarial courses and she wanted to take academic courses. And finally, I think in her junior year of high school, she became pregnant and dropped out of high school, married the father, who turned out to be the first of, I think, five or six husbands, but at some point abandoned her husband and her child and moved on to other things.
Wow. Okay. I don't want to hog the conversation, Patrick, but I have more questions, but I don't want to hog it. So if you want to jump in, please do.
Well, we're going to have to kind of wrap it up here in about 5 minutes, okay. Simply because I have a book discussion group that's out there waiting for me.
So, Zoom.
Yeah.
Let me ask a question. Because Mark, you've talked about, your sister-in-law said you got to do this because while Brent Jr. is responsible for killing his parents, she saw him as a victim. What did you go into this thinking? Were you thinking the same thing? And then how do you think now about the Springford story?
I was skeptical in the beginning because a lot of people who are accused of crimes say things like that. But as soon as she sent me that material and I could get inside the heads of Brent Jr., of his mother, of his father. And it became clear to me when you read the increasing demands that Brent Jr. made of his parents when he was living with Caroline, it's as if he was treating his family like an ATM. And they realized, because it was almost all in writing, she wouldn't let them talk to him. And although he was sending texts, he was sending faxes, they had his name on it, but they didn't sound like Brent Jr. They sounded like Caroline. They were bitter and angry and demanding and entitled, and nothing in Brent's life leading up to that suggested that he was that kind of a person. And so again, it seemed to be Caroline speaking through Brandt Jr. and not allowing his parents to speak with him directly. And that's why I came to believe, I think that's true. And also there were three fairly tortured confessions of dubious admissibility in court. And it rang true to me. Those three confessions rang true to me. And you know, there's this famous Sherlock Holmes story, The Silver Blaze, where the key clue is the dog that didn't bark. And it's like, what was not being said here? And what did not sound like him? And I became early on, you know, convinced that it was true, that he wasn't the kind of person who would do something like this. I mean, he did it, but he had no real motive to do it. And the motives he gave later in his confessions were not persuasive to me.
Has there been any interest in adapting this for, I mean, this just begs for a miniseries or a Netflix kind of documentary series.
Before The Fourth Body showed up, we were an episode in Investigation Discovery. Oh. And it's a devil's bargain with those people. I mean, you want to advance your cause, but they're going to do recreations that may not be reflective. And so instead of being, you know, a 48-year-old woman with no sexual relation, when it got to tabloid TV, she was a 27-year-old hottie, and they were going at it hot and heavy. So, but that's the deal that you make. We have had, I think, three or four queries. No offers yet, but yes, you know, with a story this complicated and with different venues, you know, yeah. Montgomery, Boulder, Wyoming, it does beg for a sort of multi-part series, but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Mark, one of our viewers online is interested in, and I was going to ask this too, how long did it take you to write this book? How many from start to finish?
Well, I was told about it in 2009 by my sister-in-law. I said, okay, I'm kind of interested, but nothing happened until my book came out in 2013. So it took me from, I would say, 2013 probably to 2018, so 4 or 5 years. I was still freelancing. You still have a family. I still have other things to do. So it wasn't four uninterrupted years. And it was at one point, it became so depressing to write about this. I gave myself a rule. I wouldn't work on the book after 8 p.m. And because I didn't want to take the story to bed with me. And that wasn't enough. So I
read it at night. So I'm actually glad you said that. So if anybody reads this,
don't read it. And then it still was too much. So I stopped writing the book for about 6 months and wrote an ebook original, a sequel to my Simpsons book, because I needed to cleanse my psyche of this horrible tragedy. And I wanted to laugh for a while. So I did that. And then I came back and I finished the book finally.
Wow. Well, it's been a real treat to talk with you both this evening. And this is the book we've been discussing. And we have copies here at the Poison Pen Bookstore, but they're all over wherever books are sold. Mark, it's been, it's been a treat to have you with us. And Christina, as always, sorry for the little rocky start, folks, but it's been a fun hour.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you, Christina. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks, everybody, for watching online, too. All right. There we go. All right, guys. Thanks so much again. I got to run and start my book group.
Thank you, Mark, so much.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the conversation.
Take care. Good night, guys.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.